Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Welcome, dear listeners, to a special presentation of Macabre, a dark history podcast. We delve into the shadows of the past where history's most sinister tales reside. These are the stories that cannot be confined to a single episode, narratives that demand a deeper exploration, an immersion into the human condition. Prepare to immerse yourself in accounts of chilling crimes, unsolved mysteries, and the darker side of human nature in this Macabre feature. Every story of a great evil has a beginning, a point of transformation where the mundane changes into the monstrous. For our story, that moment arrives not with a bang, but with the scratch of a pen on a legal document. In 1886, a man named Herman Webster Mudgett, a gifted but fraudulent physician with a history of petty scams and a trail of abandoned family, made a decision. He would erase himself. He would kill the man he was born as so that a new creation, one better suited to his dark ambitions, could be born. He filed the paperwork. Herman Webster Mudgett, the boy from New Hampshire, with the cold eyes and unsettling fascination with anatomy, ceased to exist. In his place stood a new man, a figure of his own meticulous design, christened with a name he felt embodied intelligence, authority, and cunning. A name likely stolen from the headlines and inspired by the famous fictional detective of the era. He was now, and forevermore, Dr. Henry Howard Holmes. This was more than a simple name change. It was a declaration of intent. It was his final break from a past that could anchor him, from people who knew him, from any lingering shred of conscience. With this new identity came a profound rebirth, a chilling liberation from all prior ties and moral constraints. He was now free to manipulate, to charm, to deceive, and ultimately to kill. And he had the perfect destination in mind, a city on the verge of a spectacular transformation, a place teeming with opportunity, both legitimate and illicit. His next stop, Chicago. To understand Holmes, you must understand the Chicago he stepped into. In the late 1880s, it was a raw, muscular, and chaotic city. It was a phoenix having risen from the devastating Great Fire of 1871 to become a sprawling, smoke-belching metropolis, the pulsing, unsanitized heart of the American Midwest. It was a city of breathtaking architecture and abject poverty, of robber barons and desperate immigrants. It was a place of soot and ambition where fortunes were made overnight and lives were lost just as quickly. Railroads sprawled like iron veins across the landscape, pumping waves of newcomers into the streets daily. These were Swedes, Irishmen, Germans, and young men and women from the American countryside, all of them hungry for work and the chance for a new life. And looming on the horizon was the promise of an event that would capture the world's imagination, the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition. Chicago was then known as the White City. It was a monumental fair to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in the New World. It promised wonders beyond belief, shimmering lagoons, electric lights that turned the night into day, moving sidewalks, an enormous, magnificent Ferris wheel that would touch the sky. It was projected that over 27 million visitors would flood the city's streets. For H.H. Holmes, this teeming, hopeful, and dangerously anonymous city was a paradise. It was a human sea he could swim in unseen, a perfect hunting ground for a predator who thrived on deception. He was handsome, perhaps strikingly so, always impeccably dressed in tailored suits, and his piercing blue eyes were disarming. His charismatic smile could quell suspicion and inspire immediate trust. He presented himself as a successful, caring physician, a brilliant inventor, and a savvy businessman, a persona he had been rehearsing for years and would now play to perfection. He settled in the growing middle-class neighborhood of Inglewood on Chicago's South Side. It was here, amongst the hopeful and the hardworking, that he found his first foothold. He quickly secured a job at a local pharmacy owned by Dr. and Miss E.S. Holton, located at the busy corner of Wallace and 63rd Street. The Holtons were well-liked and trusted by the community. Dr. Holton was suffering from cancer, and the arrival of this charming, capable young doctor seemed like a godsend. Holmes, with his apparent medical expertise and almost hypnotic charm, quickly won the couple over. But his sights were not set on simply being an employee. He was, after all, an apex predator, and he was sizing up the territory. He had his mind set on acquisition, and it didn't take long. Within months, Dr. Holton succumbed to his illness, and shortly after, Mrs. Holton, his grieving widow, seemed to simply vanish. To those in the community who inquired, Holmes had a ready and perfectly reasonable explanation. With a somber expression, he would tell them, she had sold him the pharmacy, finding it too much for her to bear after her husband's passing. He would add that she also conveniently left for California to stay with some relatives. In her last correspondence, he noted, to anyone who questioned her disappearance, that she said she was enjoying her time with family she hadn't seen in years and decided to stay there indefinitely. No one questioned the handsome, successful doctor who now ran the local pharmacy. With this new steady income and respectable position in the community, Holmes had his foundation. But this was merely a stepping stone. His true ambition was far grander and far, far more monstrous. With the profits from the pharmacy and a series of loans he acquired through fraudulent means, Holmes purchased the large, empty lot across the street. On this plot of land, he would begin to construct his masterpiece, a building that would serve as his residence, a hotel for the coming fair, and the future location of what would later be known, in the whispers of pure terror, as the Murder Castle. The building that began to rise at the corner of 63rd and Wallace was an architectural anomaly from its inception. The people of Inglewood watched this strange, blocky, and asymmetrical form grow, quickly dubbing it the castle for its foreboding, fortress-like appearance. It was 3 stories tall and eventually took up an entire city block, a grotesque and windowless monument looming over the quaint, ordinary neighborhood. But its true diabolical nature was a secret known only to its architect. This was no ordinary hotel. It was a purpose-built factory of death, and Holmes designed it himself with meticulous, malevolent care. During its lengthy and chaotic construction, he managed to keep the building's true blueprints and his master plan a closely guarded secret. How did he accomplish such a feat? He devised a cunning and ruthless system. The construction workers he hired were treated as disposable parts. He would hire different crews for different isolated sections of the building. One crew might build a single staircase, another would plaster a set of walls, and before they could become too familiar with the structure, before they could ask too many questions about its bizarre design, Holmes would simply fire them. He would almost always refuse to pay them, citing shoddy workmanship, and dare them to take him to court, knowing the legal process would exhaust them long before they saw a dime. This constant revolving door of labor ensured that no single person, no architect or foreman ever understood the building's twisted, full design. Only Holmes knew every secret passage, every hidden chute, every dead end. The ground floor of the castle was designed as a mask of legitimacy, a carefully constructed facade to lure the world in. It housed a series of storefronts, including Holmes' own relocated and expanded pharmacy, a jewelry store where he could sell the trinkets of his victims, a barbershop, and even a restaurant. This was the public face of the castle, the busy, respectable mask of normalcy that concealed the unimaginable horrors of the floors above. The upper two floors were a labyrinth nightmare, a physical manifestation of a psychopath's mind. There were over 100 rooms, most of them small, claustrophobic, and windowless. They were connected by a disorienting, maddening maze of hallways that twisted back on themselves or simply led nowhere. There were staircases that ended abruptly at blank, solid walls. There were doors that, when opened, revealed not another room, but a sheer, terrifying drop to the floor below, or a solid brick wall. Many of the guest rooms were fitted with secret peepholes, allowing Holmes to spy on his chosen victims from the darkness of an adjoining hidden closet. He could watch them, study them, and decide their fate. He controlled the flow of gas into many of these rooms through a series of hidden pipes, all connected to a control panel and his own locked office. He could asphyxiate his guests with the simple turn of a dial, savoring every excruciating moment of their demise from a hidden, godlike vantage point. Other rooms were more explicitly torturous. Some were lined with thick sheets of asbestos and heavy iron plates, making them both fireproof and completely soundproof, designed to muffle the most desperate, inevitable screams. The entire structure was a complex, interconnected web of traps. Hidden trapdoors were concealed in the floors of the rooms and in the bottoms of closets. These were connected to greased, metal-lined chutes that dropped directly into the building's black heart, the basement. The basement was the final destination. It was here in the subterranean realm of horrors that Holmes completed his ultimate, gruesome work. It was a place that defied belief, a personal industrial hell. It was equipped with enormous vats of corrosive acid, large enough to dissolve a human body completely. There were deep pits filled with quicklime to decompose flesh, and a blood-spattered surgical dissecting table, complete with a full set of gleaming professional instruments. On shelves, one might find bones bleached and labeled with a surgeon's precision. And in the corner stood his pride and joy, a custom-built, high-firing furnace, which he cruelly explained to the curious that this was for his glass-bending company, another one of his entirely fraudulent businesses. Its true purpose was far more sinister. It was, in fact, a crematorium, a kiln capable of withstanding immense heat, designed to reduce human beings, flesh, and bone to fine ash and brittle fragments, ensuring almost no evidence of his atrocities remained. The few employees who worked in the castle's legitimate businesses would occasionally smell the foul, sweet, sickening flesh burning and drifting up through the floorboards. But Holmes, the believable doctor, would claim and explain that it was just an unpleasant chemical smell due to some of his experiments. This was an easy explanation for a man of science to give, and one that was terrifyingly always accepted. To continue the facade he had created, Holmes outfitted the hotel's public areas and guest rooms with fine furnishings, beautiful linens, and rich decor, all acquired through his various schemes, defaulted loans, and outright theft. He was creating a house of horrors disguised as a modern marvel, a perfectly designed and baited trap for the thousands of innocent and unsuspecting travelers who would soon flock to Chicago for the promise of the World's Fair. It is a profound mistake to think that H.H. Holmes was merely a murderer. He was, at his very core, a master con artist, a virtuoso of fraud. Murder was often just the gruesome culmination of a financial transaction, the final violent erasure of a witness, a creditor, or a partner he no longer needed. His thirst for control extended far beyond life and death. He possessed a near-religious obsession with power over money and people's trust. His criminal enterprises were astonishingly vast and complex. Long before the castle was complete, he was already swindling everyone he came in contact with. Furniture suppliers, lumber companies, kiln manufacturers, and bricklayers were all left holding worthless IOUs and unpaid bills. He charmed them with grand visions and promises of prompt payment, took delivery of their goods, and then vanished into a legal labyrinth of excuses, aliases, and corporate shells. He had a particular genius for creating phantom businesses. The most famous of these was his Holmes Glass Bending Company. He claimed to have invented a revolutionary patent-pending technique for bending large plates of glass, a process that was, of course, chemically and physically impossible at the time. Yet, with his silver tongue, his forged blueprints, and his unshakable confidence, he tricked seasoned investors into supporting this phantom business, taking thousands of their dollars and leaving them with nothing but empty promises. During the fair, he preyed on the era's gullibility and its obsession with quick health fixes. He marketed and sold bogus mineral water cures, claiming they could cure everything from dyspepsia to baldness. He even created a full-fledged mail-order pharmaceutical business, sending out worthless, sometimes dangerous concoctions to desperate people across the country who were dazzled by the era's faith in scientific progress. One of his most audacious scams involved the castle itself. Before it was even finished, he took out multiple heavily inflated and overlapping insurance policies on his already mortgaged building with several different companies. Then, a mysterious fire broke out, a fire that caused significant damage, but conveniently did not destroy the building. It was a fire he almost certainly set himself. When the insurance investigators arrived, men trained to detect fraud, they were not met with resistance, but with the impeccably dressed, warm, and disarmingly polite Dr. Holmes. You have to imagine the scene. A suspicious, hard-nosed insurance adjuster, a man who has seen every trick and heard every lie, arrives at the partially burned castle. He is there to investigate a highly suspicious fire at a heavily insured property owned by a man already notorious in business circles for not paying his debts. He expects a confrontation. He's ready for a fight. Instead, he is greeted at the door by the charismatic Dr. Holmes. "It is said," Holmes replied. "Ah, my dear fellow," Holmes said, flashing his signature crooked, charming smile. "I've been meaning to speak with you. Please, won't you come in? It's far too hot out there to be arguing over money and paperwork." Reluctantly, perhaps, against his better judgment, the man steps inside. Holmes ushers him into a plush parlor near the pharmacy, a room far enough from the street to muffle noise, but close enough to seem casual and non-threatening. Holmes gestures towards a decanter of fine brandy or whiskey and pours them both a generous drink. "To our continued partnership and swift resolution," Holmes says, lifting the glass in a toast. The adjuster hesitates, but takes a drink. Holmes speaks smoothly. His voice is soothing, persuasive, lulling the man into an unexpected sense of comfort and security. He assures him that the paperwork has simply been delayed, that the funds were just temporarily tied up in another venture. His voice is hypnotic. Some versions of this recurring story suggest Holmes may have drugged the drink. Others imply that this sheer force of personality, Holmes' intense and focused psychological manipulation, was enough to calm the man and convince him to walk away. In any case, the result is always the same. The adjuster, the supplier, the creditor, all leave empty-handed, but somehow still oddly satisfied and a little confused, as if waking from a spell. Holmes' charm was so potent that seasoned creditors and even the police found themselves stalled, confused, and utterly misled at every turn. He could talk his way out of anything. He was a master of the stall, the misdirection, and the bold-faced lie. This recurring incident showed that in Holmes' castle, you didn't have to be locked in a soundproof vault to be in mortal danger. The greatest danger was simply being in a room and talking to the man himself. We may never know the true number of H.H. Holmes' victims. The official count stands at 9, but estimates from investigators and researchers have ranged wildly, some soaring to over 200. He didn't just kill, he erased people. He meticulously dismantled their lives, their finances, and their connections to the world before finally extinguishing their existence. With the 1893 World's Fair in full swing, his castle became the perfect, efficient trap. He advertised it in newspapers and with flyers as the World's Fair Hotel, affordable, luxurious, and conveniently close to the fairgrounds. Travelers lined up to stay. Many were young women. From rural towns in Illinois and distant cities in the East, they arrived in droves, seeking adventure, employment, independence, and new beginnings. They were alone in a vast and overwhelming city. They were vulnerable, and they were so easily persuaded by a wealthy, handsome, and attentive doctor. They were, for Holmes, the perfect prey. They arrived at his door with trunks full of clothes and hearts full of dreams for a future in the bustling new America. Once inside the castle, they vanished behind doors that only Holmes controlled. So many women were seen entering the hotel with their suitcases, but they were never, ever seen leaving. Let us speak of the names of those we know. To do so is to reclaim them from the long shadow of their killer, to remember them as more than just victims. First, there was Julia Smythe. She was a bookkeeper by trade, a woman left in a desperate situation when her husband abandoned her, leaving her to raise their young daughter, Pearl, all alone. She found work as a bookkeeper for Holmes and eventually became one of his many lovers, moving into the castle with her child. She was likely promised a stable life, security for herself and her daughter. But on Christmas Eve of 1891, Julia and Pearl disappeared from the face of the earth. When her former husband's family grew concerned and inquired about her whereabouts, Holmes calmly claimed she had gone to visit her own family for the holidays. Later, under the pressure of interrogation, he would change his story and confess to her death, callously claiming she had died during a botched abortion that he himself had performed. No evidence of this ever surfaced. It was just another lie to cover a murder. During the final grim excavation of the castle cellar, investigators unearthed the small, delicate skeletal remains of a child, believed by forensic experts to be that of young Pearl, found buried in the damp dirt floor. Then came Emmeline Sigrand. She was a bright, beautiful and ambitious young woman from a good family in Indiana, drawn to the promise of Chicago. Holmes hired her as his personal assistant, stenographer, and secretary. Soon, she was completely under his spell, writing letters home to her family, gushing about her new life and her new engagement to a handsome, wealthy doctor named Harry Gordon, which was one of Holmes's favorite aliases. She was entranced by him, telling friends he was the perfect gentleman. But those same friends grew concerned. They noticed a change in her, a quiet sadness that she couldn't explain. She disappeared in December of 1892. When her worried family contacted Holmes, he told them a cold, calculated, and cruel lie. Emmeline, he said, had called off the engagement and had run off to get married to another man in Europe. The truth was far more horrific. It is believed he lured her into one of his airtight, soundproof vaults. Years later, when investigators finally broke into that sealed room and examined the inside of the vault's heavy door, they found a single, faint, ghostly footprint etched into the metal. The last silent trace of a woman's desperate and final struggle for life. And then there was the Williams sisters. Minnie Williams was not a naive country girl. She was an actress and an heiress to a significant fortune from a Texas railroad inheritance. She was intelligent and had traveled the world, but she too fell under the powerful spell of H.H. Holmes. He charmed her, seduced her, and convinced her to sign over her entire inheritance, a vast estate in Fort Worth, to one of his many aliases. She was so enthralled that she wrote to her younger sister, Nanny, inviting her to Chicago for the summer of 1893, suggesting that Nanny might be a bridesmaid at her upcoming wedding to a wonderful man she had met. Nanny arrived in July. Soon after, both wealthy, educated sisters vanished without a trace. Holmes had a well-crafted explanation for every single missing person. For the Williams sisters, he told friends they had decided to travel to Europe. He even went as far to forge letters in the victims' names, mailing postcards to their distant families and wedding announcements to their friends, creating a complex, believable illusion that the young woman had simply eloped or moved away or had been swept away forever by some whirlwind of affair. For each of these women, he took not only their lives and their property, but he stole their very stories, twisting them into his own fraudulent narratives to serve and cover his tracks. These women and so many others came to Chicago seeking freedom and new opportunities. Instead, they met a fate so meticulously planned and so horrifying it continues to defy comprehension. As the glorious World's Fair drew to its close in the autumn of 1893, the dazzling lights of the White City began to dim. The crowds thinned, the tourists went home, and the profits from the World's Fair Hotel began to dry up. Holmes, ever the opportunist, ever the predator looking for his next meal, was already planning his next grand con. For this, he would need the help of his most trusted and perhaps only associate, a man who was both a partner in his many crimes and ultimately his most tragic and consequential victim. His name was Benjamin Peitzel. Peitzel was a soft-spoken carpenter, a man with calloused hands, a wife he loved named Carrie, and five children he adored. But he was also a criminal. He had a weakness for alcohol and a malleable nature, all of which made him tragically susceptible to the powerful influence of H.H. Holmes. He saw in Holmes not a killer, but a brilliant businessman, a partner, a friend who could offer him a way out of his constant, crushing financial struggles. He was drawn to Holmes' charisma and promises of easy money. Peitzel had been an integral part of Holmes' operation for years. He had helped build the bizarre House of Horrors. His unassuming, slightly sad-eyed demeanor made him the perfect frontman for some of Holmes' scams. He was loyal, he was useful, and he was deeply complicit. He didn't ask questions about the strange architecture, the odd smells, or the people who came but never seemed to leave. Maybe, as many would later speculate, he simply didn't want to know the answers. Now, with the creditors closing in on the castle and his Chicago enterprise becoming too risky, Holmes devised what he considered his masterpiece of fraud. It was a plan that required Peitzel's complete trust. The plan was simple on paper. Peitzel would assume a fake identity, that of a struggling inventor named B.F. Perry. Holmes would then take out a $10,000 life insurance policy on this fictional Perry. The next step was for Peitzel to fake his own death in a staged lab explosion. Holmes, using his credentials as a respected doctor, would then officially identify the body a disfigured cadaver Holmes would procure from a morgue and then collect the hefty insurance money. Then the two partners would split the profits 50-50 and disappear free to start new lives. It was a classic Holmes scheme, intricate, audacious, and utterly fraudulent. But in reality, H.H. Holmes had no intention of sharing. Benjamin Peitzel, his loyal, flawed, and trusting partner, was worth far more to him dead than he ever was alive. On a quiet September day in 1894 in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, Holmes put his dark, revised plan into motion. He lured Peitzel to a rented house on Calloway Street. There was no grand farewell. There was no warning. Just a bottle, a breath, and a flash of betrayal. Holmes knocked Peitzel unconscious with a rag soaked in chloroform. Then, to mimic the lab explosion they had agreed upon, he doused his partner's body with flammable chemicals and set him ablaze. When authorities arrived, they found a body burned beyond all recognition. But then, as planned, Dr. H.H. Holmes stepped in, playing the part of the grieving friend to perfection. He presented forged documents, confidently identifying the charred corpse as B.F. Perry. He claimed it was all very sad, a tragic accident, very unfortunate. But of course, he, as the man's friend and physician, would handle the difficult paperwork. And the insurance company, convinced by his solemn charm and seemingly impeccable credentials, paid him the full $10,000. But this was just the beginning of the horror. To keep up with the elaborate lie for Peitzel's unsuspecting wife, Carrie, Holmes told her that her husband was alive and well. The plan had worked, he said, but there was a complication. Peitzel was now in hiding, perhaps in London or South America, until the threat from the insurance investigators had passed. He played the part of the concerned, loyal friend, assuring the desperate and trusting woman that he was in contact with Peitzel and would reunite them as soon as it was safe. And then he made a chilling, unthinkable offer. He volunteered to take three of her five children, the eldest daughter, the thoughtful and responsible Alice, age 15, the bright-eyed Nellie, age 11, and sweet little Howard, age 8, to a secret location where they would be reunited with their loving father. Carrie, clinging to this fabricated hope, her heart breaking for the children who missed their father so much, tearfully said yes. What followed was one of the most macabre and heartbreaking journeys in American crime. For the next several weeks, Holmes led the three innocent children on a terrifying odyssey across the American Midwest and into Canada. He rented apartments, changed their names, and checked them into hotels under a series of aliases. All the while, the children, separated from their mother and siblings, grew tired, homesick, and increasingly suspicious of the strange Uncle Harry. He played a cruel psychological game with them. He bought them new shoes and fancy clothes. He fed them candy and treats. He allowed them and even encouraged them to write postcards to their mother. These postcards, filled with childish reassurances and coded messages of their well-being, were dictated by Holmes and only served to prolong their mother's agony and keep her from going to the police. He was not just their captor. He was their companion, a terrifying two-faced figure of authority and menace, the only adult they could turn to. And then, one by one, when they had served their purpose, he killed them. In Toronto, in a home Holmes had rented under a false name on St. Vincent Street, he convinced Alice and Nellie to hide inside a large, empty steamer trunk, perhaps telling them it was a game, or that they needed to hide from people who were looking for them. Once the two girls were crowded inside, he locked the heavy lid and fed poison gas through a small hole he had drilled in the top. He left their small bodies there to rot in that trunk in the cold, dark cellar. Little Howard, the youngest, the boy, met an even more gruesome fate in a cottage Holmes rented in Irvington, a suburb of Indianapolis. When authorities, led by a relentless detective, finally caught up to Holmes, they found the house empty. But the stove in the kitchen held the horrifying evidence of what had transpired. Inside, amidst the ashes, they found small bones, baby teeth. It is believed Howard was poisoned or gassed, then clinically dismembered before the remains were placed in the fire and burned. In the end, it wasn't the spectacular horrors of the murder castle, or the grand stage of the World's Fair, or the faceless, forgotten women who would finally bring the monster H.H. Holmes to justice. It was Benjamin Peitzel. It was the trail Holmes left behind, not of blood, but of children's shoes, tear-stained postcards, and burned bodies that led directly to his arrest. And the insurance scam that should have made H.H. Holmes rich became his undoing. While Holmes was leading the Peitzel children on their slow, meandering death march, the gears of justice, though grinding slowly, had already begun to turn. The insurance company, Fidelity Mutual, had never been entirely comfortable with the B.F. Perry claim. The speed with which Holmes produced a lawyer to collect the money had raised some red flags. They hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency to investigate. But the true hero of the story, the man who would personally untangle Holmes' impossibly complex web of lies, was a detective from Philadelphia named Frank Geyer. Geyer was a methodical, quiet, and deeply empathetic investigator. He was given the seemingly impossible task of finding the three missing Peitzel children. It was a search that would consume him, taking him on a grueling 5,000-mile journey across the U.S. and Canada. He started with the scantest of clues, a handful of letters from the children to their mother, postmarked from different cities across the country. Patiently and painstakingly, Geyer pieced together Holmes' trail. He traveled from city to city, Cincinnati, Detroit, Indianapolis, Toronto, showing photographs of the children to hotel clerks, landlords, shopkeepers, and anyone who might have seen the handsome man with the three sad-eyed children. In city after city, he was just a few steps behind the killer, arriving days or sometimes only hours after Holmes had left. He discovered the rented house in Indianapolis and, with local police, unearthed the horrifying charred remains of the stove. Then, his grim investigation led him to Toronto, following a tip from a neighbor who remembered a man with three children entering the house at 16th St. Vincent Street. Geyer made his most devastating and heartbreaking discovery. In the cellar of the empty house, he found the large, unassuming steamer trunk. With a pry bar, he opened the lid. Inside were the badly decomposed bodies of Alice and Nellie Peitzel. The evidence was damning, horrific, and absolute. With Frank Geyer's discoveries making sensational headlines in newspapers across the country, the net was finally closing on H.H. Holmes. He was finally tracked to Boston, where he was arrested by Pinkerton agents on November 17, 1894. But as authorities began to investigate the calm, well-dressed man they had in custody, and as the stories from Chicago and as the discoveries by Detective Geyer began to merge, they realized that his true crimes were far darker, far more numerous, and far more depraved than any of them had ever imagined. The legend of the murder castle began to emerge from the whispers of Inglewood, and America was introduced to a new and terrifying kind of monster, the serial killer. In custody, H.H. Holmes did not shrink from the spotlight. He bathed in it. He became an overnight media sensation, America's first celebrity serial killer. Awaiting his trial, he gave a series of wild, contradictory, and often entirely fabricated confessions to the press, particularly to the Hearst newspaper syndicate, for which he was paid thousands of dollars. He confessed to at least 27 murders, then later to over 150, weaving fantastic tales of his crimes. Then he would recant it all, claiming he was innocent of everything except for the insurance fraud, a mere pawn of the true villain, Benjamin Peitzel. He even claimed in a final theatrical flourish of manipulation that his face was physically transforming into a demonic shape, that he was being overtaken by an inner evil force, perhaps Satan himself. He was controlling the narrative to the very end. Though many of these confessions were later revealed to be false or grossly exaggerated, they served to cement his legend as a diabolical, larger-than-life mastermind of evil. His trial for the murder of Benjamin Peitzel began in October of 1895. It was a national spectacle. Holmes, acting as his own attorney for a time, was arrogant, calm, and defiant. But the evidence presented by the prosecution was overwhelming. The testimony of Carrie Peitzel, the financial records, and most powerfully, Detective Frank Geyer's stoic, heartbreaking testimony about the discovery of the children's bodies left the jury with no doubt. They took only a few hours to find him guilty of first-degree murder and sentence him to death. On May 7th, 1896, at Moyamensing Prison in Philadelphia, Dr. Henry Howard Holmes, born Herman Webster Mudgett, walked calmly to the gallows. He was, by all accounts, serene and showed no emotion. But his death, unlike the deaths he had engineered with such clinical precision, was not swift. The hangman miscalculated the drop required for his weight, and his neck did not snap. Instead, it took nearly 20 agonizing minutes for H.H. Holmes to strangle to death at the end of a rope, a slow, choking, gasping descent into the abyss he had spent a lifetime digging for so many others. In a strange and final revealing twist of fate, Holmes had made a bizarre request for his own burial. He, the man who had dissected, dismembered, and destroyed so many human bodies, insisted that his coffin be filled with cement and buried in a 10-foot-deep, unmarked grave. He was terrified of grave robbers. But more than that, he feared the anatomist's knife. He feared the very thing he had done to so many, to be exposed, dissected, and remembered as nothing more than a body. It was a darkly perfect, ironic final wish. And so ended the life of H.H. Holmes. But his story, his dark legend, did not end there. The murder castle, that grotesque monument to his evil, burned to the ground in a mysterious fire in August of 1895, before its full awful secrets could ever truly be explored by investigators. Today, a United States post office stands on the site where so many lives were tragically and terribly cut short. History, however, does not forget. H.H. Holmes remains a chilling foundational figure in the American consciousness, a symbol of the profound darkness that can hide behind a civilized and charming veneer. He built a castle of horrors, crafted scams with surgical precision, and murdered with a chilling industrial detachment. He was a product of his time, a dark and twisted reflection of the Gilded Age's unchecked ambition and the frightening anonymity of the modern city. He exploited the very hope and promise that drew people to Chicago, turning their American dream into his own personal horrifying nightmare. Let us not remember him for his monstrous celebrity. Let us remember Julia and Pearl Smythe. Let us remember Emmeline Segrand. Let us remember Minnie and Nanny Williams, Benjamin Peitzel, and especially Alice, Nellie, and Howard Peitzel. Let us remember them not as a list of victims and a killer's story, but as people with lives, with families, with hopes and futures that were stolen from them by a man who was the worst of humanity. Their stories, their stolen lives, are the true and tragic legacy of the devil in the White City. This has been a special macabre feature. I hope you found this chilling tale of H.H. Holmes both informative, and compelling. History is filled with shadows, and by shining a light on them, we can perhaps better understand the darkness that lies, sometimes dormant, within us all. Thank you for listening to this special presentation and limited series of Macabre. Stay tuned for more Macabre features in the future, where together we will uncover the darkest parts of history.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.